From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as NATO allies discuss what to do in Bosnia, we examine a recent turning point that may have given the Serbs the confidence to attack cities the UN had declared safe havens. We talk with New York Times reporter Stephen Engelberg about his article which reconstructs what happened behind the scenes last May when NATO bombed the Serbs, then stopped bombing after Serbs took peacekeepers hostage. Also today, a profile of American neo-Nazis. We talk with Raphael Ezekiel, who has studied neo-Nazis for 10 years. When he attended rallies or interviewed white supremacist leaders, he didn't try to hide the fact that he's Jewish. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album of British rapper Tricky. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Temperatures in Chicago were down to the mid-80s after a five-day heat wave that killed at least 144 people. Medical examiners say that the death toll may actually be closer to 300. Jody Becker of member station WBEZ reports that city officials are coming under fire for the city's response to the high temperatures.
Mayor Richard Daley spent much of this morning touring a Chicago neighborhood that's been without electricity since Saturday. Daley says the city did its best responding to the heat, setting up cooling centers and sending city workers door to door to urge the elderly to leave their homes. Daley says it's families and neighbors of the elderly, not city officials, who need to be more vigilant. Daley's also faulting the city's power supplier, Commonwealth Edison. He says it took the utility more than an hour to report outages, and that inaccurate predictions of when power would be restored may have cost lives and losses of thousands of dollars to businesses. For National Public Radio, I'm Jody Becker in Chicago.
President Clinton has met with his senior security advisors to discuss Bosnia. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman John Shali Kashvili returned from European meetings about Bosnia. The Allies and the United States are trying to find a way to turn back the latest Serbian assault. National Security Advisor Anthony Lake has said that President Clinton is firm in his decision not to send U.S. ground troops to Bosnia. Lake does say that the United States has always promised American air power would help U.N. forces when they're in trouble. Congress is holding hearings about the government siege of Waco and the Clintons' real estate holdings in the Whitewater matter this week. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle says the Democrats have some degree of confidence that they won't be hurt by the hearings and that the Republicans will have to justify themselves.
We've got some expectation that we're going to come through this thing very well. They've got to defend themselves as to what their real motivation is here. So we're looking at the next few days actually with some degree of confidence and expectation that we're going to do very well.
Majority Republicans are promising impartial hearings. Two Americans freed from an Iraqi jail say they never lost hope that their government would help to free them. They just didn't know when. William Barloon and David Daliberti are both in Jordan. They had served 4 months of their 8-year prison sentences for straying into Iraqi territory. Both men say they're angry at being jailed for a mistake at the Kuwaiti-Iraqi border. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein released the pair yesterday after a humanitarian appeal by New Mexico Congressman Bill Richardson. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 25 points at 4,733. Trading is active. This is NPR. The Senate is preparing to vote tonight on whether to cut off debate on regulatory reform legislation. EPA Administrator Carol Browner is warning that the regulatory relief bill would threaten the environment. Chuck Quernbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
Administrator Browner has turned to state officials for help in her fight against a GOP regulatory reform measure. Speaking to the National Conference of State Legislatures meeting in Milwaukee, Browner raised particular concern about a provision that would make it easier to challenge past EPA decisions.
You lose any sense of certainty, any sense of consistency, including a requirement that we reopen decisions that have withstood the test of time, like a ban on the dangerous pesticide DDT.
Browner claims many state environmental laws could also be put in limbo. The EPA chief also spoke against a House committee plan up for a vote this week, a proposal to cut her agency's budget by one-third. For National Public Radio, this is Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
Boston authorities say no one was seriously hurt in a city subway accident this morning. Emergency officials say 32 people were injured when two trolley cars collided in a subway station. Officials say one trolley was stopped inside the station when a second struck it from behind. The driver of the second trolley was among the injured and had to be rescued. The official in charge of the rescue says the car was crushed and had folded around her. Her injuries are not severe. A new survey finds teenagers name drugs as the biggest problem that they face. The Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University did the survey of 2,400 adults and teens during May and June. They cited drug problems far more than they did problems about sex, parents, or doing well in school. The poll suggests that many American children will have to make a conscious decision about whether to use drugs by the time they graduate from high school. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Clinton and his top advisors have been considering whether to use force to protect Garajda, the remaining Bosnian city designated a UN safe haven. Srebrenica fell last week. Zepa is near collapse. My guest Stephen Engelberg co-authored a story in yesterday's New York Times that reconstructs a turning point in the war that led us to today's crisis. His article tells what happened behind the scenes late last May at the UN and NATO when they agreed to bomb Serb headquarters in Pale, but halted the airstrikes after the Serbs retaliated by taking nearly 400 Dutch peacekeepers hostage and threatening to kill them. Stephen Engelberg is an investigative reporter in the New York Times Washington Bureau. He was the Eastern European correspondent from 1990 to 93 and covered the beginning of the war. I asked him why he reconstructed the events behind the NATO bombing.
Well, I think that was a very pivotal moment in the whole Western involvement in Bosnia. Obviously, there have been many pivotal moments. You can look back 3 years ago to the initial decision not to become involved more forcefully. But at that moment, there was a kind of question on the table, which is, do we acquiesce in the Serbs' renewed shelling of Sarajevo? This is now May, early May, mid-May of this year. Or we do try to do something about it. And there had been a debate that had been running through the process, for the last year, perhaps 2 years, the Americans generally arguing that if you really tried a kind of more, well, they use this strange word, robust, if you tried a more robust bombing strategy, if you were really tough with the Serbs, you wouldn't be pushed around so much. And the UN saying, no, if this happens to us, there'll be hostages taken, and we're not equipped to fight a war, we're not prepared to fight a war, and so the result will be worse than what you started with. And finally, in May, this strategy was tried, and in our article, we kind of looked at how it was tried, how it was thought through, and the outcome. And I think the conclusion would be that it was not very carefully thought through.
One American official told you that the decision to attack the ammunition depots at Bosnian Serb headquarters on May 25th, the decision to bomb, amounted to little more than drop a few bombs and see what happens. Another official told you there was no strategy behind any of this. Did you find evidence to back up those claims?
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, I think that there's a kind of great confusion about this. There's sort of many curtains that are erected. So if you go to the obvious question was, after the hostages were taken, you go to the Americans and you say, how could this have happened? The Serbs promised they would take hostages. They had lots of people in their territory, and yet you dropped bombs on them. What was your thinking behind this? And generally the answer was, well, it wasn't our operation. We merely encouraged them to do this. And if you want better answers, you'll have to go to NATO or the UN. So then you go to the UN and they say, well, we were only acting because the Americans pressured us. And you go to NATO and they say, well, we were only dropping the bombs. Don't ask us to explain what was supposed to happen next. And at the end of the day, we found no evidence of what you would normally expect in an American military operation. And in fact, we know they do this, which is a kind of, what they call a war gaming. They sit down in a room and they actually play out the various scenarios. And one gentleman or woman might play the Serbs and the other might play the other side and say, well, okay, I'm going to drop bombs. What are you going to do? So, I'm going to take hostages. Okay, well, then what we're going to do is... And they certainly didn't do that in the American government. There's little evidence that they did it anywhere else.
Why didn't they?
Well, there you get into something that's a little bit even beyond the bounds of what we wrote about. I mean, my opinion is that I don't think that people had a great deal of faith that this would actually work. I think that if you look at the all the people involved in this, there are several players who are acquiescing in this who really have no faith in it. I think at the UN there was little belief in the first place that airstrikes would really dissuade the Serbs. The commander in Sarajevo, General Rupert Smith, a British commander, asked for the airstrikes. The way this works is that he has to ask and then others have to sort of agree. And I think that he was basically, in a sense, putting the world to the test rather than trying to carry out a military strategy. I think he wanted to demonstrate that either we are going to do some very tough things, i.e. continue bombing after hostages are taken, or we're going to change his mission. And if you look at what happened after the May bombing, his mission changed rather radically. I mean, before May, the UN was responsible for enforcing what was called a heavy weapons exclusion zone around Sarajevo. It's a 12.5-mile area where there was supposed to be no artillery. And General Smith, who took his job in January, made it quite clear that he didn't have the wherewithal to do that job, nor, frankly, to protect the enclaves that are now falling before our eyes, and that he wanted to see either more force, more troops, more wherewithal to do what he needed to do, or a different mission.
Do you think that there's a degree of indecisiveness built into the system, into the relationship between the UN and NATO?
Well, I think that it's a fine system to do what you might call is consensual peacekeeping. In other words, if you have a place in the world where there has been a war and the parties have stopped fighting, but there's a great deal of tension, and you want to prevent an accidental outbreak of hostilities, and they all agree that they will bring in the so-called Blue Helmets, UN troops, I think then things work very nicely. But then you don't have to worry about calling in airstrikes on the whole. I mean, these parties have agreed, and the thin blue line, if you will, is there as a kind of tripwire to prevent them from going at each other's throats. And there are many places around the world where this works quite nicely. I mean, Cyprus has had UN troops there for, I think nearly two decades. It does not work in an area where there is no peace to keep. And so what you have now set up is a situation which is neither war nor peace. We are clearly not at war with the Serbs, and yet we are doing things which help their adversaries. If you again go back to the beginning of this, they were besieging Sarajevo, and part of their military strategy was to starve the populace. What did we do? We delivered food. They have airplanes. They fly planes. What did we do? We declared a no-fly zone, which, of course, only affects one side. I mean, by no means were we of huge help to the Bosnian side, and I should hasten to point out, as any Bosnian government official, hearing this recitation would, that the most important thing the UN did is prevent the Bosnians at the outset from ever being able to buy the arms that they need to defend themselves. And in that, the West has been implacable in refusing to change that.
Getting back to the May bombing, the NATO bombing of Serb headquarters in Pale, what was the United States' role in deciding to bomb and then deciding to stop the bombing?
Well, American officials would tell you that we had no role whatsoever, that these two institutions, NATO and the UN, operate independently, and far be it from us to really have much to say about that. The truth of the matter is that, number one, the United States is, like it or not, the most important member and the most influential member of the United Nations. We pay a substantial amount of the budget, although I suppose if the Republicans on the Hill have their way, less so. But we still pay a lot of money, and we are the preeminent member of the Security Council. And so when, as happened in this case, when the United States Defense Secretary and the United States representative to the United Nations go to Boutros Ghali and sit in his office as they did and say, we think you should try airstrikes. We think you haven't done the right thing here. We are, more than willing to see NATO do more, and we think you must do it. That has a disproportionate effect. It is not as if one of 185 countries have come in and said that. That's the first point. The second point is that NATO and the planes that carry this out and the officers that plan it are so-called dual-hatted officers. They are NATO people, but they're also Americans. And the notion that what went on in the planning of this at NATO was some mystery or some completely separate thing from what goes on at our Pentagon is, I think, also really very hard to credit. So at the end of the day, we certainly get the ball rolling, and I think for that, the responsibility for going in and pursuing the strategy is squarely on the American side. I think the question of stopping it's a little bit different. I mean, it is, and I think here the administration has a pretty good point, once things have gone wrong and it is British and French troops who are threatened, I think it is rather difficult for America to say, gee, we're very courageous, we would like to fight until the last European has fallen, since we have no troops there. And this has been the sort of defining and constraining aspect of this from the beginning. As long as you have no troops there, when things get very sticky, you really have nothing to say.
What are the options being examined now, to your knowledge?
Well, they're rather fairly stark. I mean, I think you have two basic choices. And, you know, the West has been marvelous throughout this thing at splitting the difference between the two choices. I think that you can, first of all, do what the French are suggesting, which is to reinforce the United Nations force. So that's first and foremost, make it stronger, which is already in process. That's the rapid reaction force that's now being added. And then use that for a purpose. Now, the French proposal is to save the last of the eastern enclaves that has not yet fallen, which would be Garajde. If you don't do that, you could use a stronger sort of United Nations force to try and draw more defensible lines around the central part of Bosnia and hold off the Serbs there while hopefully the Bosnian government becomes stronger. The other alternative is to leave. And that is Senator Bob Dole's proposal. He says we should get out, the UN has failed, and we should then arm the Bosnians. The problem with that is that, twofold. Number one, that if you tell the Serbs that you're going to be arming their enemies as soon as the last UN soldier is out of Bosnia, that would give them a rather powerful incentive to delay the departure of those UN soldiers by force if necessary. And the second point is that even if the UN soldiers do withdraw, you have a second sort of question of what will the Serbs do while the Bosnians are receiving their arms, and the answer, of course, is take everything they can, because, again, it would be a very foolish military tactic to delay confrontation while your enemy is made stronger.
Newsweek is reporting that the NATO allies will try to halt the Serbs at Garajde, which is the third city that the Serbs are expected to try to overtake, and that Washington is taking a serious look at airlifting 1,000 French troops into the Muslim enclave. Newsweek says that at a meeting last week, General John Chalikashvili, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, presented a plan for the massive air assault at night with the largest helicopter armada since Vietnam. These would be American helicopters. And that the operation would almost certainly result in American casualties. What do you know about this?
Well, I don't know specifically about the meeting that Newsweek refers to. The proposal, generally, as they describe it, is the one that's on the table. I mean, there's more than one. There's a number of different ways of doing this and sort of different levels of force that could be applied to it. I think we are now at a point where the rubber is meeting the road, and because that plan quite clearly implies a rather direct confrontation with the Bosnian Serbs. To do that plan is to attempt to frustrate a key military objective of theirs. And it says, as you describe it, that the NATO allies are planning to do this. I would question that. I think that some in NATO are planning to do this. Clearly, the French are on board, and I think the Dutch have always been quite favorable toward this sort of thing. The British are not. And it's their troops in Garajde right now. The British look very dimly at this proposal. They think it's a bad idea. And I'm not so sure that the Clinton administration yet has the backing in Congress and even within its own administration to do this. This is an incredibly serious step.
What would the United States, what kind of approval would Clinton need before committing attack helicopters?
Well, of course, the president has been debating about this sort of War Powers Act and all of that for a long time. I think that President Clinton has the authority to do this without Congress's approval. I think the fact is that if they tried to pass a law to stop him, it would be, you know, the helicopters would have long flown by the time it got through. But there's a political dimension here. We are no longer, you know, sort of in the middle of Mr. Clinton's term. We're now on the eve of a presidential race. Bob Dole, his likely or a likely opponent, has staked out a position on this issue. And I think that Clinton would be very uncomfortable dispatching this many American troops for this big a deal if he felt that the sort of consensus on the Republican side in Congress was that it was a huge mistake, because it puts him in a position, if it goes wrong, of being suffering substantial political damage.
My guest is Stephen Engelberg, an investigative reporter in the New York Times Washington Bureau. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Engelberg, an investigative reporter in the New York Times Washington Bureau. He co-authored an article in yesterday's paper about events in the Bosnian War that led to the current crisis. In your article yesterday in the New York Times, you wrote that the failure of the May airstrikes seemed scripted from the start. What do you think NATO would have to change to be successful in a new round of strikes to protect Garajda?
Well, some of the things that they would have to change have already changed just because of the way the situation on the ground is different. Obviously, you want to reduce the potential for hostage taking. And the number of UN soldiers that are in Serb-held territory in exposed positions is much lower. On the other hand, I have to say, there are still 300 Dutch being held as of today. And in Garajde, the UN forces are obviously themselves surrounded by Serbs, although protected. So I think step one is reduce hostages wherever possible. Step two, unfortunately, is you have to accept that there are going to be hostages, and this becomes a very tough thing indeed. If you want to play this game with the Serbs, you have to get what the strategists call escalation dominance. That is to say, you have to persuade your opponent that you are willing and ready and able to escalate to a point of pain beyond which he wants to accept. And in this case, that would mean that if they seize hostages, you substantially escalate. You deal a major blow to the Serb military machine in Bosnia. And perhaps, and this is, I know of nobody discussing this in Washington, but it's clearly an option for them, at least countenance taking the war across the border into Serbia proper.
Now, let me ask you, if there is, if NATO prevents the fall of Garajda, if they fight off a Serb attack, and NATO and the UN prevents the fall of Garajda, what possibly could happen next after that?
Well, it's actually a very disheartening and important question, because at the end of the day, what have you got? To review the bidding on this, we began in May, with a map on the table. The Serbs currently hold 70% of Bosnia, and they were being offered a map in which they would get to keep 51%. And they said, no, that's not acceptable. We're not going to sign that. And they then proceeded to take one, and today probably the second, enclave Zepa, and to at least threaten the third. So they've said, okay, we've now wiped out two of the three enclaves. Well, the history of this has been that if you preserve the third enclave, the Serb tactic is to fall back, bide their time, and then begin, as the world's attention turns elsewhere, to probe and to pick at it and to take off little bits here and there where they can, and to get ready for the next assault. The fact of the matter is that until you are willing to fundamentally change the military balance, this business of trying to just defend and hold things off is a kind of endless shrinking, if you will. It's a commitment that has no end to it. It's a commitment where there's no bottom to it. It doesn't stop. And so if you hold Garajde, what then? A year from now, you may be looking at an attack in the enclave on the west of the country called Bihać. Or you may see them chipping away in the north of the country. I mean, the fact is, as long as they have the capability to make war, and as long as you've done nothing to stop them, this is an endless and sort of festering problem.
Where are you looking right now for the next developments in the story on Bosnia?
Well, I think there is a basic question now, which we posed in the opening sentence of our story, and which I'm still kind of curious to see what's going to happen this week, as to whether the U.S. is going to stand up and lead. What is the U.S. role going to be? Are we now going to say, well, that's a very nice proposal the French have made, but we're sorry, you know, Congress won't accept it, or we're sorry, it's just too complicated, or we don't like the command arrangements, or any number of a half dozen excuses that can be made. Or is this president, this administration, going to stand up and say, even at this late date, enough is enough? Because I think that will tell the story. If militarily, without us, none of these wonderful things that are planned for the Rapid Reaction Force can really be very successful. I mean, the fact is, when it comes to providing intelligence, when it comes to providing lift, i.e. delivering the troops where you want them, and when it comes to providing air cover through NATO, you know, we are very, very preeminent players. And so there's a lot, you know, there's a lot here that we need to find out about the American role. What is Washington going to do? I don't know whether this administration necessarily wants to be in that position, but, you know, if 20th century history has taught us anything, it is that Europe is not very good at managing its own affairs, and that ultimately America has to play a leadership role, you know, or look at the results.
Is there a lot of division in opinion over, like, which option now is more likely to lead to a wider war?
Well, I suppose there are two different ways of looking at that. The wider war within Bosnia, to my mind, is clearly fueled by the withdrawal of the United Nations force entirely and the arming of the Bosnians. You then really have a kind of free-for-all. But the possibility, I suppose, is that, and this, of course, takes several leaps, I suppose the possibility of a war within the region, you know, exists if you go the other route. In other words, if you strengthen the enclave in Garajde and you, as the West, kind of brook an open conflict with the Bosnian Serbs, is there a point at which the Serbian Serbs come across the border to help their brethren? And if that happens, does that then pull in the Russians and the Greeks and all the rest? I still believe that to be somewhat far-fetched, but I think you have to become a little bit nervous about that, because any point at which the West is seen as kind of overrunning the Bosnian Serbs, you are certainly courting, you know, intervention from across the border, and that that is something that, you know, puts you in sort of terra incognita. I mean, from there, who knows what would happen.
Stephen Engelberg, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Stephen Engelberg is an investigative reporter in the New York Times Washington Bureau. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, The Racist Mind. We talk with Raphael Ezekiel about his 10-year study of Klansmen and neo-Nazis. Ezekiel attended white supremacist rallies and interviewed the movement's leaders without hiding the fact that he's Jewish. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album of the British rapper named Tricky. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Serbian forces are threatening UN peacekeepers again if NATO airstrikes are launched against them in Djepa. The UN safe haven is near collapse. The Serbs have attacked the city with artillery and mortars. Serbs say they'll turn their guns on the UN soldiers if NATO planes interfere. Jets buzzed the Muslim enclave yesterday but did not attack. A UN spokesman denies that Serbian threats have paralyzed the United Nations. They say NATO air power is still an option. Meanwhile, Russia says it opposes the use of Western military force in Bosnia. Foreign Minister Andrei Kosarev says the deepening crisis in Bosnia can still be solved by peaceful means. Paul Brandis reports from Moscow.
Kosarev told the Interfax news agency that the Kremlin remains opposed to airstrikes against Bosnian Serb positions. NATO warplanes last week attacked the Bosnian Serbs but failed to stop them from overrunning a Muslim enclave in Srebrenica. Kosarev says he's been in touch with Boris Yeltsin over the matter, but he's not saying whether he actually saw the Russian president. Yeltsin's in the hospital recovering from heart problems and will remain there until at least the end of the week. Reports on the president's medical condition are scarce, but Kosarev says there's no doubt Yeltsin's health is improving. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Brandis in Moscow.
In Jordan, two Americans pardoned by Iraq say they were treated fairly during their four-month imprisonment. NPR Cindy Collin reports from Cairo.
Freed Americans William Barloon and David Deliberti said they were never tortured during their 113 days in detention in Iraq. Speaking at a press conference in Amman, Jordan, the two men said they were innocent victims in a chess game between Washington and Baghdad. Barloon and Deliberti strayed across the Iraqi border last March and were sentenced to 8 years in prison for entering the country illegally. The men were pardoned yesterday following a meeting between Congressman Bill Richardson and Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Richardson told reporters that he had met secretly with Iraqi diplomats several times to pave the way for his visit to Iraq, but State Department officials said they never authorized him to negotiate on their behalf. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
Separatist rebels in Kashmir, India, have released a tape recording of an American hostage pleading for his life. The man is one of five Western hostages who were kidnapped 2 weeks ago. The rebels are threatening to start killing their hostages today unless 21 jailed rebels are released from Indian control. The American hostage identifies himself as Donald Hutchings of Spokane, Washington. It's not clear if he's speaking of his own volition or reading from a prepared statement. The rebels from the mostly Muslim Kashmir state have kidnapped Westerners before but released them unharmed. On Wall Street, stock prices climbed to yet another record today on Wall Street. The Dow gained 27.5 points to end at 4,736. This is NPR. German police suspect a race-motivated arson attack may have been the reason for a fire that injured 20 people, including four children. NPR's Dieter Berger reports.
Apartment occupants noticed the fire when it broke out overnight in the stairwell of their apartment building in the town of Remscheid, near Dusseldorf. Injuries were caused largely by smoke inhalation. Mostly Turkish residents live in the apartment house. Local officials say there are indications the fire might be the result of arson. The Bonn government recently announced the number of right-wing extremist attacks continued to decline in 1994, but remained far higher than before unification. The vast majority of attacks were directed against foreigners and minority groups. This past year, there have also been more than 100 attacks in Germany on Turkish-owned businesses. Few arrests have been made in connection with the attacks, which police blame on Kurdish extremists as well as on right and left-wing Turkish extremists. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The lead attorney for Oklahoma bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh says he wants the trial moved out of the state. Stephen Jones told NBC he may seek to move it out of the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. He blames increasing worries on pretrial publicity. Jones had said earlier he'd hoped the trial could be held in Oklahoma, but now says he's growing more skeptical. Federal prosecutors say they plan to fight attempts to move the trial. McVeigh and Terry Nichols are the only suspects charged in the bombing of the federal building that killed 168 people. Paper companies Kimberly Clark and Scott have signed a merger agreement valued at $6.8 billion. Officials say the combination will create a global consumer products giant with $11 billion in revenue. The boards of directors of both firms have already approved the stock swap deal. There's no word on when the shareholders will vote. The Kimberly Clark shareholders will own 58% of the new company. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For 10 years, Raphael Ezekiel investigated a world where he knew he wasn't wanted, the world of neo-Nazis and other militant white racists. Ezekiel is Jewish. His goal has been to understand the beliefs at the core of the movement and the life histories that lead to membership. He's attended Klan and Nazi rallies and interviewed leaders of the groups Aryan Nations, the White Aryan Resistance, and the Southern White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Ezekiel is on the faculty of the Harvard School of Public Health, where he recently began to study youth violence prevention. He creates psychological portraits of militant white supremacists in his new book, The Racist Mind. I asked him if the racists he studied knew he was Jewish.
I made it a point to be extremely open and extremely honest with these folks, partly because since I'm asking people to be open with me, I really have to demonstrate my own openness, and also because it's just an ethical matter. I think you have to be honest.
So who would know when you got to a rally? Not everybody who was there would know who you were.
Well, the leader whom I had notified, whom I had said, look, I'm doing this, I'd like to come by, is that cool with you? He would know, and he would have told some of his associates. But in the chapter where I describe the Klan rally at Stone Mountain, we have an example of a time when my identity was gradually established for most of the people who were there. And there was a great deal of hostility that erupted.
Was it at Stone Mountain where somebody said to you, are you kosherish?
Right. Yes. Zenful said, are you kosherish? And with great intelligence, I said, huh?
Yeah, had you ever heard that expression before?
No. I don't think anyone has.
This is just something he made up? It's not a common...
Well, he was trying to figure out how to say what he was trying to say. And then when I said, what? He said, are you by any chance Jewish? I said, indeed I am, yes.
And what did he say then?
He said, out, get out, out the gate. And one of the other people there said, it's okay. So-and-so said, it's all right for him to be here. And the young man went off to find the Klan leader, the wizard, who had authorized my presence and who was running that rally. The young man came back after a while. Yes, the wizard had said, that guy can be here. The young man looked at me. He ground his jaw. He stared at me, and he said, kill the Jews. I got no use for a kike. Keep Hitler's dream alive. Kill the Jews. He said that a few more times, and he obviously was trying to incite me.
And what did you do?
I went off. I came back. I said to him, look, I did not mean to disturb you. I thought it was obvious that I was a Jew. And if this were the right time and the right place, I'd like to talk with you about why you're saying what you're saying. He said, if it were the right time and the right place, I would show you. And said one more time, kill the Jews. Keep Hitler's dream alive. Kill the Jews. So I went, walked off. And some months later, I had the chance, in fact, to sit and talk with him, which was extremely interesting.
What kind of questions did you ask him?
Well, I was sitting talking with one of the wizards, and another member who was a lieutenant for the wizard, and with this young fellow, whom I call Arthur in the book. Arthur sat quietly for the first 2 hours of the interview. He had on his lap a young blonde kid, about 2 years old. I couldn't quite tell whether the child was a boy or a girl. He was holding this little child on his lap with one arm. His other arm reached into his pocket early on, and he drew out a large clasp knife and opened it. And as I was talking with the others, he would stare at me and run his thumb over the blade of the knife. And about 2 hours into the conversation, he suddenly burst in and said, "Castrate the males, sterilize the females, chain them in the backyard for dogs." I said, "What?" And he said, "Castrate the males, sterilize the females, chain them in the backyard for dogs. That's what I do with Jews and blacks. You were asking what would we do if we came to power. That's what I would do. That's what I was thinking." Interestingly,
Go ahead.
Arthur himself, later on, a couple of years later on, left the organization he was in, the Klan group he was in. Briefly, he was leader of that group. It fell apart under his leadership. And soon thereafter, he and a new girlfriend moved from Atlanta up to Chicago to start a new life. On the way out of Atlanta, he called up the Morris Deese anti-Klan organization, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and said he wanted to tell them what he knew. They interviewed him. He had nothing new to tell them that they didn't know already. But it's kind of striking that someone who, on the one hand, could say things that sound as though they come from a deep conviction, on the other hand, can turn against his group so thoroughly. And that shallowness of attachment was something I kept running into that I still find puzzling.
You know what I found interesting? One response from somebody who found out that you were Jewish at a white racist militant rally was, "Well, I take it you're here in a professional capacity, not as representing all Jews. If you were here representing Jews, then I might really have problems." It's,
right.
It's as if this person knew that he wasn't going to hurt you and he didn't particularly want to hurt you, but he had to have a real good reason for not hurting you.
Yeah, yeah. I think throughout all of this interviewing, a funny thing was happening. I think, on the one hand, it's interesting that people were cooperative, that my openness was met with relative openness. That's interesting. And partly it says something about, partly it has to do with the fact that visually I look like them. Visually, I'm a white man. To them, I'm not. I am a child of the devil, literally, because they believe, quite seriously, that Jews are children of the devil, biologically. But when they sat across the table from me, there I was with my blue eyes and my gray hair. I didn't have a great hooked nose. You know, their cartoons of Jews look like medieval pictures of Jews. I didn't look like that. I think were I an African American, I would have had a very hard time doing this work, because visually, every time they looked at me, they would have seen, "Hey, he's on the wrong side." I think they lost track of that as we spoke to one another.
My guest is Raphael Ezekiel, author of the new book, The Racist Mind. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Raphael Ezekiel, he's a social psychologist who spent a decade investigating the emotional and psychological motivations of militant white racists.
You know, you write that in the 1980s, the racist movement hitchhiked on farmers' fears during the farm foreclosure crisis, and now they're hitchhiking on the fears of gun enthusiasts, people who are afraid of new restrictions on guns. And I guess that's where the militia connection comes in.
Yes, and since the militia are so new, we don't know much about them. It's not clear to what extent racist organizers have been active in recruiting for the militias. It's very clear with the militia of Montana, which is one of the original groups, that one of the primary organizers there is a fellow from Aryan Nations. In Michigan, it's not quite so clear who these folks are. It's certainly clear that the insecurity that is very widespread in the country is one of the motivating forces for that organization to come about.
In places where there is a connection between militant racist groups and militias, do you think that the militias are a sign that racists, organized racists, are becoming more dangerous, more armed?
I think I'm going to dodge that question. I think that we are in a time of considerable danger that will get more and more dangerous. And yet, I don't really think that the greatest danger comes from armed opposition groups like the militias. I'm really much more afraid of what people at the center may do to increase central authority using incidents like the Oklahoma City bombing as an excuse for limiting democratic freedoms. I think this is a greater danger than that the discontent would become strong enough, those who are discontent would become strong enough to take power themselves. I think that's unlikely as long as we don't have a catastrophic depression.
After a decade of studying organized white racist groups, how dangerous do you think they are?
I think they play a critical role in helping to buttress racism in this country. I think they help keep the ideas alive. They are capable in selected communities of terrorism and of intimidation. They historically have had an enormous impact. They continue to have a strong impact. Their most important effect is they keep the ideas thoroughly alive, and their rhetoric attracts to them individuals who are capable of very strange and violent action. So I think they damage the fabric of the community, and they do hurt people.
One of the things that must be true about people who are militant racists is that they have no ability for empathy. No ability to imagine themselves as anybody but who they are.
Yeah, that seems to be true. I found them a remarkably... It goes beyond not empathy. It's a great lack of imagination in general, a fairly joyless lot. And in my interviewing, I often would say playful things to them, playing around with things, and they never got it. They never got a joke. They're not living a very happy life one would not want to live inside their heads.
You say organized racism is about a mood, lonely resentment.
Yes, resentment. We have been cheated. We have been cheated. What should have been ours has been taken from us. And obviously, many, many people have that mood.
As a Jewish person, having spent a decade studying neo-Nazis and Klansmen, are you afraid?
You mean today, am I afraid?
Uh-huh.
As a Jewish person?
Yeah. You feel personally threatened? Yeah.
I feel threatened by the increasing racism in our society. I feel threatened by the increasing cruelty of the dominant mainstream creed. For the first time in my life, I have some feeling that there could, in fact, be fascism in this country. But if it happens, I really think it will come from the center and not from the extreme groups. And I am afraid of it.
Why don't you think it would come from the extreme groups?
Because I don't think the center would permit the extreme groups to gain that much power. We're not a fragmented society as Germany was at the end of the Weimar Republic. Again, as I said earlier, a catastrophic depression might mean something very different. I am afraid that as the economy becomes worse and worse for great numbers of people, there is going to be a drift toward fascism. We really need in our own lives, where we work and where we live, to act, to create real community and real democracy. If we create a vibrant, strong, democratic culture, we have nothing to fear. If we don't, we have a lot to fear.
Raphael Ezekiel, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Raphael Ezekiel is the author of The Racist Mind. He's on the faculty of the Harvard School of Public Health. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have from Bosnia?
We'll have a report on what the situation is on the ground, Terry, and then we'll have a report from Silvia Poggioli on diplomatic efforts and one from Martha Raddatz on U.S. policy regarding what is happening now in Bosnia. Also, we're going to look forward to the Whitewater hearings, which start tomorrow. We'll have two reporters who will be catching us up on what the Whitewater situation is and what we know for sure. Daniel Shore also has a commentary on that. We have a follow-up story on Oklahoma City and what the situation is there, raising money to rebuild and how people feel about it.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A popular sound in England these days is something called trip-hop, hip-hop music that gives off a dreamy, spacey aura. Examples of trip-hop acts are Massive Attack, Portishead, and Tricky. Tricky is a 27-year-old whose album Max and K is one of the most highly praised albums of the year. Rakuta Kentucker has a review.
The primary roles Tricky performs on his album Maxing K are those of producer and rapper. He's sifted together bits of reggae, dub, funk, and industrial music, along with samples of other people's songs to achieve a very dense sound. A teenage singer called Martina provides the girlish, willfully naive vocals. It's as if she's skating in a very wobbly way over the top of this deep, frozen lake of music. The The music that Tricky is making originated in Bristol, England. He was once a member of Massive Attack, by far the most commercially successful trip-hop act. In fact, it was Massive Attack's breakout pop success that moved Tricky to leave the group, lest he be thought an artistic sellout. There's an air of vapid artsiness about a lot of what Tricky and his cohorts do, and I don't think as highly of this work as many of my bedazzled colleagues do. But there's no denying that when he hits the right groove, Tricky makes music that has an irresistible allure. I think one reason listeners are latching on to Tricky's stuff is that its druggy tempo and wayward melodies fly in the face of current pop trends. In the wake of grunge noisiness and the stingingly precise clarity of everyone from Michael Jackson to Hootie and the Blowfish, Tricky's drifting murkiness comes as a kind of lulling relief. It's probably not music for the ages, but rather an exceedingly witty form of muzak. If I was younger, I'd suggest it was music to nod off to. As it is, I'd say it's music to take a nap to.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Alan Tu, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Kathy Wolf, Nancy Updike, and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Kenesha Baker is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
It's too good. It's too nice. She makes me finish too quick. Is it love? No, not love. She turns my sexual trick. She says she's mine. I know she lies. First I scream, then I cry. Take a second of me, you beckon I'll be. She suffocates me. She suffocates me with suggestion. I ask, do you feel the same?
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.